Paul, thank you very much. That's a very nice and thoughtful introduction. I mean, usually when I do this, and I do a fair amount of this with this job, the introduction is literally read from our website, and it sort of recites the litany of prior jobs and some of the case highlights. But the care with which you prepared that is consistent with the way you have always approached your job, has approached our friendship and our relationship, so I really appreciate that. And it's just another reminder of why I really like coming over here. I was talking to Dean Jeffries and Dean Mahoney before about how I unfortunately had to give up teaching at the law school when I received this position. I can't have any kind of outside official affiliation. And I really miss the time I spent teaching at this law school. And having an opportunity to come back for events like this really means a lot to me, so I really appreciate the invitation. I thought I'd talk for, 30 minutes or so about why you're all here, and that's public service. Why it's important, why I have chosen to do it, and I hope to leave you with a bit of a sort of instigation to the extent you need it. If you're here on Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock, perhaps you don't really need it. But anyway, I'm going to try to inspire you to recommit to it. And I thought I'd start that process by talking a little bit about one of the real highlights of my time so far as U.S. Attorney. That was just a couple of weeks ago. It was on January the 21st of this year. I happened to be in Washington for some meetings at the Justice Department, and it was the 50th anniversary of Robert Kennedy's investiture as Attorney General. And Eric Holder, the current Attorney General, had organized a big celebration, a big ceremony to honor Attorney General Kennedy and his legacy to the department. And he'd invited the Kennedy family, which would take up most of this room. All of his children were present, including Max Kennedy, a classmate of Jim Ryan's, who was here at this law school as a student, who I had known, and all of their children. It was a huge crowd of Kennedys. Ethel was on stage. And there were a lot of civil rights leaders that were there, as well as some folks who worked with Robert Kennedy when he was Attorney General. John Lewis was there, and he talked about being on the Freedom Ride in the summer of 1961, when he was first, Robert Kennedy was first Attorney General. And Robert Kennedy calling in protection for the buses as they rolled through the South, and how much that meant to Congressman, now Congressman Lewis, and the other Freedom Riders. And Charlene Hunter Galt was there, and she was one of the first African-American students at the University of Alabama. And she talked about attending a speech that Robert Kennedy gave while Attorney General to a group of students at that institution, in which he challenged them on the issue of segregation directly, showing great courage. There were people there that had worked closely with him, and they talked about his intensity and his passion for justice and how demanding he was as a boss. And then his family talked a little bit about his personal qualities and his devotion to his family. And then Eric Holder stood up, and he talked about connecting all of that legacy to today. And he told all of us assembled that we have an obligation to follow along that legacy, that we don't work for just any client or just any cause. We work for justice, and that means something special, that means something unique, that we should all leave inspired in that commitment. I was sitting at that event next to my friend Neil McBride, who was a roommate of mine at this law school, who's now my colleague across the state. And the two of us periodically would turn and look at each other, sort of in this silent appreciation that we were here at this moment, that we had started here together at the law school and had come to serve and carry on this legacy. And just a little bit earlier that day, we had been in the Attorney General's conference room, which was Bobby Kennedy's office. It's this beautiful wood-paneled room with these paintings. And Robert Kennedy actually had his desk, and that's where he had his office, because he wanted a big space. He was very collaborative and communal as a leader, and it's now a conference room. But I'd been sitting in that very room just a couple of hours before discussing a violent crime strategy with Attorney General Holder. And again, I just felt this sense of appreciation and privilege to be able to carry on the ideals of Robert Kennedy. Because I do feel like what I do as a public servant is something larger, is a cause, is a calling. And that gives me a great deal of satisfaction. I left that meeting that service really inspired. And I thought that feeling is what I'm trying to instill, if possible, help you want for yourselves. If you can someday walk out of a courtroom or a meeting with a client or some kind of ceremony with a similar feeling that you're doing something significant, then I suggest you'll be a success. Now, let me start with the threshold proposition that each of you has the potential to do great things, to have an impact on the world. Robert Kennedy's most famous quote is this: "It is from numberless diverse acts of courage and belief that human history is shaped. Each time a man stands for an ideal or acts to improve the lot of others or strikes out against injustice, he sends a tiny ripple of hope. And crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring, those ripples build a current which can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance." What he means is that each person, himself or herself, can change history, can do great things. Might be a tiny ripple, but it joins with others and it alters the course of history. He believed that and he acted upon that. And I start today with the threshold assumption that each of you can do that. Maybe difficult sitting in big lecture halls in this law school at a relatively youthful age to see the path to that or to believe in your own sense of power and capacity, but you have it. You're all extremely talented. You wouldn't be here if you weren't. You all have in you the capacity to be a ripple of hope, to do something significant. And I'd encourage you to start with the proposition in your head and in your heart that you have that skill. You have the skill and the capacity to make an impact. Making an impact is the way in which I suggest you'll be most satisfied as a lawyer. The things that I have done in my career that have been the most satisfying have been the things that have had impact. I remember really specifically a trial that I had when I was a prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C. And it was not an important case. It was not a case that had any press attention. The case involved a woman named Tawana Bailey, and Ms. Bailey was addicted to heroin, struggling even just to in a coherent way tell the story of how she'd been victimized. She lived in an apartment complex, and the manager, who was the person who collected the check every month, was extorting her to have sex with him, and he would give her some sort of financial break on the rent. And Tawana Bailey said no. She said, "I'm not going to submit to this." And he was so enraged at her refusal that with a lead pipe, he beat Tawana Bailey. And she defended herself by holding up her arms. And she came into court with casts on each of her arms, broken forearms from defending herself against Cyrus Jackson, was the defendant's name, who beat her with a lead pipe. And we didn't really have much evidence against Mr. Jackson other than Ms. Bailey and her testimony. But we spent time together, got her to the point where she could tell the story coherently. She could withstand cross-examination. She testified in the case in D.C. Superior Court. Mr. Jackson was convicted. And after he was convicted, we walked out of court together, and she was crying. Tawana Bailey was crying. I remember her nose was running, and she was really, like, shaking. She was trying hard to kick this heroin addiction. She hugged me, and I said, "Well, you're emotional." She said, "No one has ever cared about me. No one has ever paid attention to me until this case." So the case was a small victory in the annals of our office and the kind of work that we do. But to Tawana Bailey, it made an impact because somebody cared about her, because someone cared enough about her, the system cared enough about her to help her get justice. And I knew at that moment that I was in the right line of work, that I had the skill and I was devoting my time day after day to help people feel like there was justice. Help victims feel somehow restored, care about them, pay attention to them. And there are Tawana Baileys all over the world that need your help. Think about impact and think about your own capacity in a very small way as a tiny ripple to have an impact. How do you go about preparing for that impact? I want to talk just a little bit and give you, if I can, just a little bit of advice about how, if you choose this path, to go about it. I get the question all the time from people, "I really want to be an AUSA. What do I need to do to get there?" as if there is a path, a well-defined path that they can walk, things that they can do to prepare. And I always give the same answer. I say, you know, be excellent at whatever you do. Be good at it. Doesn't matter if you go to a local prosecutor's office or you go to a law firm or you hang a shingle. There really is no standard way to get one of these positions. What you ought to do, rather than look at your legal education as a sort of trade school, is to focus on skill building and experience gathering, rather than this step leading to another, leading ultimately to a goal. I think too many of your peers are too practical and are too focused on things to do to lead to a particular outcome. My suggestion, my strong suggestion to those who ask and to all of you, is you can have an impact by being good. And you ought to be focused on gathering experience, relationships, skills, not so much on what do I need to do to get where I want to go. Okay? Things will emerge if you do things that you like, if you do things that interest you. You'll build skills, you'll gather experience, and you'll be excellent. Right? If you like what you do, you're going to be better at it. That's been my experience. And when you're good at it, you have other opportunities. The best preparation that I had for being a federal prosecutor was the 1 year I spent as a high school teacher. My first year after college was as a English teacher at a private high school in Washington, D.C. I coached and I taught 10th and 11th grade English. I didn't do it because I thought that that would build a skill to get me into law school or help me try cases. But the experience that I gained in that job, I now realize, was very, very practical. I stood up in front of an audience of young people, somewhat skeptical audience, and I had to convince them to listen to me, to pay attention to me, that what I was saying was persuasive, was credible, much like I do as a trial lawyer. In that school, it was an incredible array, diverse array of students. A lot of them, not a lot, several of them, had children and grew up in inner city environments very different from mine. So the exposure that I got, having come from a relatively sheltered suburban upbringing, to a group of young people that were growing up in extreme poverty in an inner city, was broadening for me. And again, in my job as a federal prosecutor, I met a lot of Tawana Baileys and people that grew up in a way very different from the way I grew up. And that exposure and the comfort, frankly, with people different from me also really informed everything I've done since. So again, think about experience. Think about things that'll be fun and interesting. Think about gathering experience and skills, and not so much about practically what you need to do to get somewhere else. Now, let me talk just a little bit about the rewards of public service. I think I'm preaching to the choir here, but just in case, there are a few reasons why you should do it. There are a few very specific things you get from it. When you are a public service lawyer, you are an advocate for black or white, not gray. Let me explain what I mean. It's important to appreciate shades of gray, but I think it's more satisfying to be an advocate for the black or the white. Law school teaches us to appreciate shades of gray, and that's an important skill. You need to, if you're going to be an effective advocate, learn to see the complexity in a situation. Learn to understand the argument on the other side. It's a crucial skill. It's one that this law school teaches you well. But it's satisfying, more satisfying, I suggest, to, while understanding both sides, take a position, particularly a position in which you feel strongly. Public service law allows you to be an advocate for a cause, for a movement, for something larger than yourself, for the black or the white. When I was hired by Eric Holder as an assistant U.S. attorney, the current attorney general was my boss when he was the U.S. attorney in D.C. He sat me down on his government fake leather couch in his office, and he said, the day that he swore me in, and he said, I don't have a lot of rules for you, but I have one that it is absolutely critical. He said, you're going to have awesome discretion in this job. The decisions that you make are going to directly impact the lives of the people around you. At all times, in your exercise of that discretion, do the right thing. Do what in your gut feels right, feels fair. And it may not always be the most aggressive prosecutorial thing. It may mean that you disappoint some people. But you have to always trust your gut about what's fair and what's right. Always remembered that. because he's right. I have the benefit in this job of always being able to do what I think is right. I am not a lawyer that has to make an argument or take a position for something that I don't necessarily personally feel that strongly about or even agree with. I do what's right, and that feels good. In this job, there's lots of gray and there's lots of black and white. Very early in my career, soon after I got that talk, that pep talk from Eric that day on the couch, I was involved in a case with another lawyer. It was a drug case. There had been a search warrant executed, and there was a young man found in the residence at the time of the search warrant with a lot of marijuana. And the agents recovered the marijuana, they secured the cooperation of the person who was present, and they then went out based on that information and found his supplier, the ultimate source of the marijuana that was inside of the residence. And it became this sort of domino effect of further investigation after the execution of the search warrant. And as we were interviewing the arrestee who had cooperated, we went through the story about where he'd gotten the marijuana, and then we started talking about what happened on the day of the search warrant. And he said, he actually kept sort of rubbing his shoulder as if he was in some sort of pain. And finally we said, "What's wrong with your shoulder?" And he said, "My shoulder just hurts from where they dropped me." And we said, "Dropped you? What do you mean?" He said, "Yeah, you know, I was handcuffed behind my back and the officers picked me up a few times and dropped me on the ground." He said it as if that's just what happens, that was okay. He wasn't complaining, actually, about it, but we were concerned about that, those facts. So we had a little huddle. You know, well, what do we do? This arrestee, you know, this admitted drug dealer, is telling us that he was physically abused by the officers that arrested him. The officers, some of the most active drug enforcement officers at the Metropolitan Police Department. That was a black and white moment. Right? There's no gray involved in that moment. What we did was we confronted the officers and we said, you know, heard from Mr. Smith here, the arrestee, that he was dropped a few times. And the officers really, you know, they didn't really deny it to their credit. They also thought, what's the big deal? We got what we needed, we got the information. And the information that they got was accurate because they acted on it and they got further up the chain in the drug conspiracy. We dismissed the case against the arrestee. We dismissed the subsequent case against the people because the evidence was tainted. Because it was not right and it was not fair. Even though the means were successful recovery of drugs and the information was accurate, the process by which it was obtained was unlawful. And we institutionally cannot countenance that, cannot accept that. There were consequences for that, not just with respect to those cases which were dismissed, but with respect to those officers. They were suspended and off duty for a long time. Personally very angry with me and with the other lawyer who turned him in. And it was very difficult for us with some other officers to sort of overcome that reputation as being, you know, a finger pointer at officers. But that was a clear black or white moment. And those things happen in your career. And again, when you're in public service law, you have the ability to say, this is one of those situations. I'm on the side of the angels, the truth. What's fair? And that is really, really satisfying. So appreciate shades of gray. Think hard about different sides of an argument. But I think you're more satisfied as a practitioner if you have the ability to stand up for justice, for what's right, for what's clear. That's one of the real benefits, I think, of public service. I remember very specifically on September 11th, 2001, I was in D.C. I was interviewing a prisoner in the gang case that the dean mentioned in my introduction. There's a knock on the door from the marshals, evacuate the building. Walked outside and there were F-16s flying around. Our office was just a couple blocks from the U.S. Capitol. Went inside, walked back to the building and saw the second Twin Tower fall on live television. And as immediately, all the agents that were working on my case started searching dumpsters and immediately deployed to this kind of spontaneous, all-hands-on, secure alert. And all of us were told to stay put. There may be arrests or maybe things that... We were all immediately sort of part of the response. That felt, in a weird way, know, being part of the solution, really good. And I remember talking to a friend of mine who had left our office and was in private practice, and he felt exactly the opposite. He said, that was the day that I really missed being in the U.S. Attorney's office. Now, I'm there talking about a lawsuit between companies, and I really wanted to be on the front line, helping, fighting, right? When those moments come, I had a satisfaction that in some small way, you know, I was on the side of justice and the side of truth, and I still feel that way. Because my world is more black and white, maybe, than other lawyers, because of the choice that I've made to do this work. So, appreciate Shades of Gray, but be an advocate for black or white. The other thing about public service law that I think is so satisfying and is a reason to pursue it is that it shows you how interconnected the world is and people really are. We're really more alike than we are different. And this work helps us appreciate that. Let me read you something else that Bobby Kennedy said. He said, we must admit the vanity of our false distinctions among men and learn to find our own advancement in the search for the advancement of others. We must admit in ourselves that our own children's future cannot be built on the misfortunes of others. We must recognize that this short life can neither be ennobled or enriched by hatred or revenge. Our lives on this planet are too short and the work to be done too great to let this spirit flourish any longer in our land. Of course, we cannot vanquish it with a program nor with a resolution, but we can perhaps remember, if only for a time, that those who live with us are our brothers, that they share with us the same short moment of life, that they seek, as do we, nothing but the chance to live out their lives in purpose and in happiness, winning what satisfaction and fulfillment they can. Robert Kennedy realized that we're all part of a human family, that we share a common humanity that binds us. That view of the world motivated him. He saw connection, not distinction. And remember, he was Attorney General at a time when the world was full of distinction. Legal, the law was full of distinction. And he worked very hard to change that. Public service law gives us an opportunity to work for, recognize, and work toward that connection. One of the things I love about my job is that I have, in the same day, an opportunity to spend time with a Tawana Bailey and then make an argument to a federal judge about some fine point of law. The breadth of it and the diversity of it and the exposure of it to different parts of our patchwork of humanity is really exciting and really satisfying. And if you work for migrant farm workers, or you work for disadvantaged children, or you work, you realize that people like that are more like you than different. Are people with rights and desires and needs. And it's not like you can't do that in a law firm, but it's different. There's a leveling effect of this work that, again, is more satisfying. You're not an advocate for the rich. You're an advocate for a cause. And again, that emphasizes connectedness. And I think that is, in my experience, very, very satisfying. And something to keep in mind as you make your choice. Now, I want to make two last points about looking forward. And I want to encourage you to look forward by realizing that there are many, many opportunities to serve. Many needs in this world that could use the talents and the impact of people like you. Robert Kennedy said, all of us might wish at times that we lived in a more tranquil world, but we don't. And if our times are difficult and perplexing, so are they challenging and filled with opportunity. He said that in the 1960s. It's absolutely true today. We live in a world full of conflict, full of challenge, full of vexing, difficult problems that need to be solved. That creates opportunity. You don't have to look very far from your chairs to find that cause, to find that need, to find that thing that motivates you to do. They're everywhere. They're here in Charlottesville. They're all over the world. So it's a target-rich environment if you want to do this. Whatever it is, there are plenty of causes and people that need your help. Pay attention to them and pick one. Pick the one that moves you. In private practice, let me say just a word about that. You can similarly do good things. It isn't as if I'm trying to suggest that there's public service lawyers are angels and people that work in private practice are somehow misguided. I spent a lot of my career in law firms. And there are ways in which lawyers in private practice do wonderful things. But keep in mind that your world is bigger than your job. I started working at a law firm after I became an assistant U.S. attorney back in 2006. I had been an assistant for 13 years, and I was sort of ready to do something else. I went to join a big law firm as a partner. And I felt kind of immediately like I wasn't doing enough to sort of impact the world. So I talked to my friend Andy Block, who's seated in the back, about maybe I should do some sort of volunteer work. There's got to be a need somewhere in this community for somebody with my skills. What could I do? And Andy suggested the Blue Ridge Juvenile Detention Center here in town. Why don't you go over there and see what you could do? So I went over there and I started this book group where just kids that were incarcerated read stories. And we got together once every couple of weeks and we talked about the book. And they wrote in journals about their reaction. It wasn't graded and it wasn't anything that was part of their official curriculum. But hopefully, in those conversations, you know, they learned something about decision making or about choices and the impact of choices. And I felt like, you know, I made maybe a difference in those kids' lives in those conversations. Nothing to do with my job. So there are ways all over the place, as a lawyer, as a person, to have an impact. Many opportunities to serve. In my current position as U.S. attorney, I know that I have 4 years. Hopefully I have more than 4 years, but I know I have at least 4 years to serve. That's gonna fly by. I'm a year and a half into it. I sometimes think, man, where is the time going? I don't want that time to go by churning the wheels of the small smiles cases and the dirty sheriff. Those are important things to do. But everybody does that, right? I got a unique opportunity in this job, in this part of the world, to do something significant. So in our office, we've created a new endeavor about crime prevention and community outreach. We created a new position in our office. We hired a person who's not a lawyer, and all she does is travel the district looking for active crime prevention programs and try to match them with federal resources. The Department of Justice, part of that Kennedy legacy, does a lot more than just lock people up. And our community outreach coordinator is actively looking for people doing positive things in communities and trying to find ways to support them. That work's being done in the same communities where we're doing big, impactful cases. Danville, Virginia, terrible unemployment. It was a plant right on the river in Danville, the Dan River, that closed about 15 years ago, the Dan River plant. Unemployment's close to 20%. In the wake of that, they have this terrible economic disparity, unemployment, open-air drug sales, gang activity. I get a news summary every day compiled by our press secretary, and some kind of shooting, some kind of robbery in Danville every day. Because that's a community that's struggling. So the way you address that, first is by identifying it proactively. Let's spend some time in Danville because they're struggling. On the enforcement side, let's make a big impactful case. Let's find the people that are really driving those drug sales, who are recruiting in people into gangs, who are committing those acts of violence. Let's target them. Not the small-time drug sellers, but the people really driving the violence. And let's try our best to identify and lock them up. That's our core function. But at the same time, if we don't try to deploy resources to programs and people in Danville that are doing positive things, other people are going to step right in behind them. So the pastor that started the Coalition for Safe Danville, he wants a community development block grant. To further his youth mentorship program. We're going to try our best to help him put his hands on that federal money. Because the only way you solve community problems is if you simultaneously focus on the front and the back end, and you try to hit that problem in that community from all directions. That's what I want us to do in this district. That's why what we're doing is different Prosecutors have forever been focused strictly on that back end, right? Let's find the bad people and let's lock them up. And there's nothing wrong with that. And that is, continues to be an important part of what we do, but it's only part of the solution. My vision, with my limited opportunity, is to do it differently. The Attorney General, very supportive of this, has given us some money, even in a bad budget, you know, environment, to create this position, to do it as a pilot. And I hope that if we can prove that it's successful, then it'll be replicated around the country, and it'll become a standard thing that everybody does in every U.S. Attorney's Office, because we started it here. It'll become part of the Holder, you know, legacy. It's too early to tell if it works or not. I hope it will. I see anecdotally positive signs that it does. But it's an example of limited moment, significant need, take advantage of it. Think yourselves about where are your Danvilles? Where are the needs in your community, in your life, that can be filled? What can you do to cast a tiny ripple of hope and make change in a place like that? Nobody's going to tap you on the shoulder and tell you what it is. You got to think about it for yourself, but you can. And if you do, I think you'll be pleased. The second piece of advice that I want to give you is to be creative and to lead and not follow. Again, Robert Kennedy, let no one be discouraged by the belief that there is nothing one person can do against the enormous array of the world's ills, misery, ignorance, and violence. Few of us will have the greatness to bend history itself, but each of us can work to change a small portion of events. And in the total of all those acts will be written the history of this generation. Eric Holder gave a talk 2 days ago in Montana, the University of Montana Law School, 100th anniversary of that institution. And he was thinking about Robert Kennedy because he was there with me at that event a couple weeks ago. And he picked up on this theme. And he said, will we continue our nation's long and noble commitment to the pursuit of justice, no matter how difficult or consequential the sacrifices involved? Will we roll up our sleeves, seek out those in need and at risk, and take the steps necessary to generate change? Will we exhibit the grit, the ingenuity to build, to innovate, to create new opportunities for others? Will we demonstrate the irrepressible tenacity and boundless optimism that has characterized the generations that preceded and extended our nation's greatest traditions? 50 years later, same priority, same sense of purpose. Robert Kennedy and Eric Holder. Eric Holder's talking about leadership. He's talking about innovation. He's talking about generating change. He realizes in that quote that it requires creative, youthful optimism. If you wait for someone to show you the way, it will not happen. Robert Kennedy didn't do that, and you shouldn't do that. The temptation when you are seated in your chairs is to take the well-worn path. Law firms come and to the law school, and all you have to do is walk upstairs in your suit, and they'll give you a good job and a lot of money. There's nothing wrong with that, but that's easy. Not wrong, it's easy. My encouragement to you is to think about something hard, something difficult, something where the path is not quite as defined. That is how things have changed in the world, is people making their own new paths. And I encourage you to think about that. Think creatively about what to do with this moment and with those capacities that you have. Don't just blindly follow and take the well-worn path. It's harder to blaze your own trail. I read a book not long ago, which some of you I'm sure have heard of, called Three Cups of Tea. It's about this guy, Greg Mortensen, who was a hiker, and he got stuck out in near K2. He was kind of rescued by these men from this village in the mountains. They literally nursed him back to health. He committed at that moment to build a school in that community, that remote mountainous community. He raised like $6,000 or $8,000 back in California, and he built a school. Had people from the village haul the materials up the side of the mountain. He now has built hundreds of schools all over Afghanistan, mostly for women who don't have the opportunity to go to school in that country. He saw a need. He creatively identified a path. that's heroism. I'm sorry that Andy Block just left, because you have somebody like that here. Andy Block, when he came to Charlottesville, saw that there was a need for an organization that would be an advocate for children. So he created one. He didn't apply for a job. There's no job. He conceived of an organization, an entity that would be, would represent kids, would be an advocate on a policy level to change the law, to benefit children. Children who are abused and neglected or have special needs or have been incarcerated. He was a pioneer and he created the organization called Just Children, which even though he's left, continues. That's going to last way beyond Andy Block's time there. Right? So with your degree, with your skills, you can be Greg Mortensen or Andy Block. You have that capacity if you're creative. I haven't been one of those people. Right? I've been one of those guys that applied for things that existed and took paths that were more defined. And I really respect that sort of pioneer spirit that people like Andy have demonstrated. And I encourage you all to think about that in yourselves. Being creative, being leaders and not followers. Because that's really how you alter the course of history, as Robert Kennedy said. I want to end with another and final, very sort of poignant Robert Kennedy quote. Shortly before he was killed, Robert Kennedy was interviewed by David Frost, who at the time, back in the 60s, was sort of one of the preeminent journalists, because he asked really good and insightful questions, and he got people to talk about things, very personal things that others couldn't do. And he asked Robert Kennedy about what he would want to see in his own obituary, again, shortly before he was shot and killed. And Robert Kennedy said, and I'm quoting, "something about the fact that I made some contribution to either my country or to those who were less well off. I think back to what Camus wrote about the fact that perhaps this world is a world in which children suffer, but we can lessen the number of suffering children. And if you do not do this, then who will do this? I'd like to feel that I'd done something to lessen that suffering." I think Bobby Kennedy did something to lessen that suffering. In his very short life, he did. What will you do to lessen that suffering? The world is there waiting for you. You have so much potential. Do something to lessen that suffering. There's no reason why you can't. So go do it. Thank you.